thing about Nixon as president instead of Humphrey isn't necessarily what goes, what you see on the surface. The worst thing are the appointments that are made to commissions. Just whether it's a Supreme Court or whether it's a Trade Commission or a Labor Relations Board or whatever, where all kinds of decisions are made that are complete sellouts to big business and the average person doesn't know what's going on. So I'm not trying to imply that that this field isn't important. What I am saying is that I would like to see a greater attention of young people toward how do you implement the things Bucky's talking about, and not assume that the only way out from all our problems is laws, because it isn't. I mean, you know, I hate to say it, but I can see it. I can see it in every city I go into. My first wife, who died 18 years ago, was an architect. That's how I met Bucky. And she was, you know, one of the people in the 30s and 40s who fought for and worked hard for public housing. Well, public housing in the big cities today are either unsafe buildings, or the wrong place to bring up kids, or being abandoned right and left, and millions of dollars of government money are in these big buildings that are a mess. And I'm not despairing in terms of, you know, there's an alternative way. But I could go through example after example of what's happened through laws and government that just doesn't work out the way we hope.
Isn't this possibly a reason for more participation by more people, instead of leaving government to them, to just a few people make the laws for everybody else?
No, I'm sorry. Bucky was on a committee with Hubert Humphrey and others, and there was government money involved to plan this great new city in Minnesota that was going to be an example to the whole country. And again, I know after 4 or 5 or 6 years of committee meetings and whatever, Bucky doesn't bother going anymore. Now, I don't know everything that went on, but my only guess can be that because there weren't enough people involved with technical knowledge and authority, that it's a fizzle, because the government and the politicians are making decisions and they haven't got the knowledge. One of the reasons I was late tonight, it's a very fascinating thing. Bucky, the May issue of Popular Science, their 100th anniversary issue, has a new house Bucky's design, which they're going to sell the blueprints of as a geodesic home. I forget the square footage, but it's relatively small, but for $500 more or less, depending where you are, you can get the materials and do it yourself. And I've been talking with him, as Victor knows, about talking with some of the natives about a larger size for use in Alaska. We were talking this evening. I started talking to him about Barrow, having been up there a year and a half ago, And I said to him, I don't know why, if one of your domes is now going up over the South Pole, why a dome over the city of Barrow wouldn't be a great solution for many of their problems. I don't know what it would do to the permafrost, whether once you put the dome up, gradually the land under it could then become usable, or maybe it would only get soft and be worse. And we were talking about the sewage problem, and Bucky wanted to know why the human excrement and so on wasn't turned into gas and energy. And I told him that all that it is, it's piled up by the thousands of oil drums sitting out at the end of the airport runway up there. And a chap came up to us as I was trying to grab something to eat and come over here, who is from Barrow and wanted to talk to him about putting a dome over their new high school up there. So all of a sudden, maybe something's going to happen. But what I'm getting at is that if the politicians who are putting up the money for the high school and the architect who has to design a building, just as the Wood Center is so incongruous, a battlement. If these are the way you're going to make the decisions, you're going to make the wrong decisions. And that's all I meant. I meant that the young people have got to do more than get into the old-fashioned politics. They've got to get more up here about the decision about design and direction. It's too easy to get caught up in the political area, as we've known.
This brings up a very, very interesting point in terms of a number of things you've said and what he said. First of all, his damn specialization. He has spoken again and again of the need for being comprehensive. Yet both he and you have made the point of the need for very specialized knowledge, which implies that the education should be designed such to provide a person with a specialty and with a generalized background in science, humanities, arts, etc. Not the joke which we currently have, which is as much a fault of lack of seriousness on the part of the students as it is on any other thing, a lack of sense of that it's important, that if we're going to try to do something, it's to try to do it on the basis of knowledge. And that if each of us as specialists are also comprehensivists, we may have, for the first time in history, specialists who know their own limitations and therefore have the ability to work together. And I don't mean this derogatorily against specialists, because I'm becoming one myself. It's you don't know your limitations until you discover them. It's not merely a matter of not wanting to find them. It's only by interacting with other people that you begin to discover this. And if we all have this common background of philosophy, of way of thinking about things, common goals of the type of thing you're talking about, we may achieve this, and we may achieve much more of this social technological synergism that he's been talking about than we ever can with the isolationism that the specialties now suffer under.
Well,
put.
Yeah, I was going to say there's really you've answered what you've asked and done it very well. After all, Bucky isn't saying that you don't have to learn that 2 and 2 is 4, and you don't have to learn if you want to be a specialist in chemistry or metallurgy or whatever, that you don't have to do your homework and do it right. What he's saying is that you've got to have a general education and an overall outlook, and not be departmentalized. That, you know, this is where your nook. I mean, for instance, there are all kinds. I don't consider myself an intellectual, because I found that in all kinds of fields, there's a jargon, there's an educational jargon, and there's a social worker's jargon, and all this nonsense wherever you go. And they get together in their own little conferences, and an outsider can't understand half the things they're talking about. And this is true in civil service or in whatever area it is. And I think this is the kind of thing he's talking about, that you've got to, there has to be an intermingling, and not feel that, you know, this is my niche, and if I don't stay here, I won't eat, and I won't have a job, and et cetera, et cetera. But having made the point, then I think one gets from Bucky's philosophy that you've got to be yourself, you've got to be an individual, you've got to think for yourself, and this is the way the world is, you know, going to contribute to the world. It isn't all of us thinking alike by any means.
Do you have any suggestions? Does Bucky have any suggestions on how to overcome this hurdle of jargon?
Well, I'm sort of smiling to myself, because if you read his book, he's got his own jargon.
Yeah.
And his answer to why he has his own jargon is that this was the best way for him to either invent new words or to say what he meant and to say it well. Look, jargon where it has a purpose, if technology, is one thing. I'm talking about I'm sure Mrs. Bartlett remembers Maury Maverick, and during World War II, he invented the word gobbledygook, which perhaps most of you now know. And in Washington, he put out all this. From time to time, he'd put out examples of governmental gobbledygook that nobody could understand, this kind of jargon. Well, this is the kind of insurance contracts are the best. Who here knows if you've got any kind of an insurance contract? I don't care if it's auto insurance, life insurance, or what. It is impossible to understand. And part of it's purposely impossible, but even when they're trying to be honest, they don't know how to say anything that you can understand.
I wanted to mention something. One of the greatest works in mathematics was Principia Mathematica by Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead. And I was reading an autobiography of Russell, and he said he was, he had, in trying to organize this book, he had taken the steps that most other people had taken in going in this direction, and he had gotten stuck at the same place. But the one key that enabled him to write this great book, which pretty much explains mathematics from nothing to everything, is the idea of a minimum vocabulary. In other words, not using so many words, and just cutting it down to just the essential words that you need, and then building up from there. And this is another example of reducing jargon.
Well, I don't know. I can only tell you my own experience. And whether it's because I'm lazy or whether what I'm about to say is factual, I'll let you judge. But having spent a good part of my life putting out press releases and writing speeches, I have prided myself on having simple words and keeping my vocabulary down to a real minimum. And I find various friends from time to time are rather amazed, and they use words, and I, you know, I say, what's that mean? And, you know, they think with my background and all, I should know. And I don't know, and I don't care to know. Because I know that when you're writing for newspapers, you, and I don't mean that people are stupid, but you, if you want something understood, you put it in simple language.
Doesn't seem to me to be consistent with Bucky and Bucky's outlook, nor perhaps with mine. In fact, because well, he starts off an article back there in 66, 67 in Saturday Review, talking about one edition of the Concise Dictionary that has 32,000 words in it, and Shakespeare used 10,000, I guess, in his lifetime, and. Bucky is capable of using about, what is it, I don't know, 5,000 an hour. And I have a feeling that he'd like to use, in 5,000 an hour, he'd like to use 3,000 different ones, and he'd like to put together 500 other ones, and maybe repeat then 1,500 ones that he couldn't get away from. But and that is, that's a real challenge to make yourself understood, and yet, in other words, to use with precision words in that way. Of course, he uses them poetically, because many of them add up adverbially, you know, and they become rather poetic, and I'm not sure how careful he is with them then. But actually, there is such a great potential for a new language. We were kicking around last evening after the lecture, variations of orthodox, and from my experience with isomers of the derivatives of the benzene ring, we created metadox and came upon paradox, we, thinking about our conversations today with Bucky, I was, you know, there's a monologue and dialogue, but you can go ahead. And many people are very, very reluctant to create new words. And this is makes chemistry extremely difficult to teach, because they think makes them look foolish to say methane, ethane, propane, butane, pentane, heptane, octane, nonane, decane. And usually I don't press them any farther than that. But as Bucky says, one evening going home from school, my little two-year-old was sitting in the back of the car, bouncing up and down, and we're looking out the window merrily, noni, 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 noni. And these are things that I think that there's some kind of an urgency to use new words and to try and use them with precision, because that's the development of this thing that Bucky kept pointing to so much last night, the mind.
Yeah, but look, there's I don't see anything.
A newspaper has never been held up as an example of good.
That's what I want to say. I don't see any
good literature.
Well, this is the point I wanted to make.
No. Was a journalist.
Look, the point, there's, I don't think see any disagreement. All I'm saying is, as a publicist who wants to get something printed and understood, the simplicity is important. What we were talking about earlier was the nonsense of gobbledygook in civil service or in certain areas or professions. It's used to make people feel important in their group, and it's used to keep outsiders out. You don't know what we're talking about. I'm not talking about the use of technical or new words that have a purpose and that enlarge your thinking and so on. This is all great. I think these are all different areas.
Fine. Yeah, well, I think that point's well taken.
One thing I was asking, though, when I asked about overcoming some of the barriers of jargon, were jargon in the non-gobbledygook sense, the useful jargon. Very often, two different fields will develop jargon, they'll develop different jargon. And
they eventually get to the point of sophistication, where if one could look at both, one would discover that they've gotten down to discussing the same types of things with very different words. And there is a problem here in terms of definition. Each of our definitions is in terms of other words. But that which we find in other words is only the explicit. There's a great deal of definition which is implicit, which you generally find only by interacting with other people using the words. I used to try to educate myself in fields by reading books. I found I got 99% misconceptions because I didn't know what was implicit in what was being said. I had to go and talk to people who were versed in the field and sometimes even take courses to begin to get a sense of this. So there seems to be something lacking in our process of definition. I've got some ideas on how we might cure it, and I don't know if Bucky's interested. I'd love to write from him and get feedback. And even on this campus, I think it would be great to talk about things like that, you know. Defining words, what actually goes into a definition and where they are failing us, especially in the technical fields. I mean, just, it's so hard to communicate.
This is a point that, well, I've been trying to carry on conversations with philosophers. And that's finally the arguments have been reduced to that point that we need, instead of passing each other, say, with jargon or with pretentious words and so forth, that we try and find common words that we can agree upon and maybe start from there. And of course, I don't know. Sometimes I feel philosophy as per se has a magic to it, but it's really extinct. And I think there are a lot of scientists who feel it is extinct. But when you begin talking about things like bioethics, which is coming out, the philosophers say that it's meaningless because there is no ethics in science.
Well, they draw the meaning. You have to have a context to understand what the word means. And for instance, a biologist hearing the word for the first time has a context to draw from to understand ethics, to understand bio. But the word put together doesn't really mean anything. Doesn't Fuller say something about philosophy?
Doesn't Fuller say something about philosophy and no more secondhand guide?
One thing to think about in terms of philosophy is something one of my philosophy professors once said when I asked him about defining terms. He says, don't you think they're more powerful when they're ambiguous?
Yeah.
In fact, he coined the phrase potent ambiguity in the sense the same way a poet uses it, that you are trying to say so many things that if you can use one word which means several things at the same time, then you more closely approach what is actually happening in your mind, because you're making many associations at once. You're not actually doing what you do in mathematics very often, other fields of more or less going in a chain. And I think this is part of the problem in understanding philosophers, is their thought processes seem to be, in many cases, organized differently.
One of the most significant aspects of mathematics is ambiguity. In fact, the most important terms...
Invisibility.
Okay. That's an aspect of ambiguity. The most important terms, like point, set, function, are pretty well undefined. And in fact, all attempts to define them have failed and have produced disasters. And so the basis of mathematics, as one mathematician said, mathematics is a house built on sand. So ambiguity has its place everywhere.
They're undefined, but does that mean they're ambiguous?
Pretty much.
I think there are a lot of, maybe sort of exercising my prerogative that I really haven't had much chance to do today, and it's only a prerogative, I guess, by agreement with Steve Roth here that we could carry on something even in Bucky's absence. And I think it's significant that we try and do this because, well, as I tried to say at the outset, Bucky is not with us all the time, and it's important that we ask ourselves what have we just heard, what have we just witnessed, and
not witnessed, participated in. Let me interrupt for a minute. I realize that many people are frustrated because they expect they're going to ask questions of the speaker. And this gets very difficult, as I'm sure you now recognize with Bucky, because just as last night, I think Vic said something about, you know, how long are you going to talk? We were walking down the street, Vic, and I think Bucky said probably an hour and a half. Now, his decision to speak 3 hours was one that he made after he'd started, after he felt that people, you know, that at least most of the people there wanted to hear more, and that he had so much to say and to give. And it's very difficult after one of his talks to all of a sudden start asking questions because, you know, most speakers will answer with something quick and he'll get started and there'll be another hour. I've had the press come up and want press interviews. I had this in Philadelphia recently. And, you know, this is insulting. It's one thing to come to him when he arrives by plane and ask certain questions. But after listening to him for 2 hours to come up in one interview, I mean, what the hell was the guy doing there in the first place if he's got to have an interview? But in terms of the student, while he may not have answered specifically a question you had in mind, it at least he's given you something to think about and go do some reading on.
Maybe that's where we should go to get to bed and get some sleep so we can start reading what we've got. There are not very many books out in the bookstore presently, I think, by Bucky, and I must say that I had thought of the idea we might get some in advance of the lecture and did not take any action on that.
Well, I think his publishers are pretty stupid. We keep sending them the itinerary and they keep doing nothing about it.
I see. It's nice to have somebody to share the blame with. Well, I do have a program from last evening for Vitey that we slipped in to Bucky today, and he did endorse. And let me see, my things are under here, I guess, aren't they? And I guess I can, well, you can read it yourself, I believe. Well, that's why I wanted to pull it out before Herman left, because he better be able to read it.
I can try.
Yeah, the really hard thing about this page is that the more you think about it, the more you find that different things could be interpreted a lot of different ways. And so you come down to saying, well, how did he mean it? And
don't forget, there are certain people in the world today, especially in this, you know, various things that have come out of India.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are certain cults. It would be very simple for us to develop a Bucky Fuller cult. And form an organization and raise money, et cetera, et cetera. This is the last thing in the world that he wants. So when you say to me, how did he mean it? Again, I can't speak for him.
Right.
But my assumption is all he meant it was to get you thinking.
Right, right. Well, that was.
Now, obviously, if he's talking about how you build a dome, then there is mathematics and there is stress and there can only be one way. But when you're talking about philosophy or you know, all the rest, I mean, he's not a deity. All he's trying to do is say, open your mind and let's all play a better game together.
No. There is one other use beyond that, which I sometimes find a need for, which is when I come up with ideas, is the need to back them up. In my studies in wildlife behavior, I'm trying to do some fairly novel things. So I have to convince people who have money, who have facilities, etc., to do them. Therefore, I have to be able to justify it in logic with authority, references to people who have authority, etc. And many of the things he said are like this synergy ideas, are ideas that I've been dealing with for several years and been trying to, which have been very important in the development of my own thought, and which I'm trying to use to justify the way I want to study bears in the next few years. But the people I talk about say, well, what basis do you have? If I was at the point where I could say, okay, Buckminster Fuller has used these same ideas successfully, it's not just a freak idea, it has been used successfully, then it's much more persuasive to them. So to understand what he means,
get along with these people and find that it was exciting to have them meeting, you know, to talk about the use of resources, apparently. And of course, one of the most astonishing things really to me, and maybe it's just naivety, is the fact that the Alaska pipeline hasn't been built, because just look, there was enormous momentum to get this thing going. Look at the pipe that's here.
I'm wondering about that too.
And it's been stalled now. It's been stalled. And I don't think that one would have anticipated.
He came through last September. And on his way to India, and then he was coming back again, so that, you know, this would be very feasible. What are you sticking that thing on my face for?
It's all good in the four stars.
Trespass nature pretty well takes care of most of these things. And the fact of the matter is,
I like its solution.
Well, the point I want to make is that he has studies which show, as the energy in use, energy output and use per capita goes up, your birth in per capita goes down. There's an absolute cross point, whether it's the U.S., whether it's India, it hasn't gotten there in India, whether it's any nation, that the energy output goes up, births per capita comes down. And we can show you this in country after country. I mean, part of what he's saying is there were 13 births per family, you know, in the early days of this country because you needed people to farm. And now it's 2 or whatever the number is. And this hasn't come down just by birth control. It's just it's come down partly because the way nature works or whatever. Thank you. No, he gets into a lot of arguments with Margaret Mead and others who feel that he's hurting their cause with some of his.
I think he made quite a point of it.